Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
So I went to a wedding a few weeks ago. Voluntarily, I was asked to go by my wife. Friend of hers and a casual friend of mine was getting married. I was glad to be there. I was glad to go. You know, I'm not exactly the kind of guy who wakes up in the morning and says, I can't wait to go to the wedding today. I'm not that guy. I usually go with a few thoughts in mind. First is, I hope the wedding is short. You know, I mean, a long wedding is just so unnecessary. I remember back when I was a DJ, and I was actually DJing the reception after this wedding of this hugely charismatic couple. And I mean, religiously charismatic. They had three preachers. They had three pastors at the wedding, and each pastor gave a sermon. Oh, it's excruciating. It just went on and on and on. And you could see people fidgeting in their chairs. Have more respect for your audience. You can mark the occasion. But sometimes less is more. A wedding does not have to be 90 minutes, right? That's my first thought, is I hope it's short. I hope it's about quality, not quantity. My second thought is that I hope it's about the couple, like a personalized kind of ceremony that is unique to these two. Because so many times, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, when you go to a wedding, and it's like they went to the wedding store, and they said, I'll take package A, please. And they're just cookie cutters. We've all been to, most of us have been to those types of weddings. You go in, it's usually in a church or some kind of a rented hall, and you're sitting down, and you're waiting, and there's, you know, some light piano music playing, and all of a sudden the bridesmaids begin to walk in, and you hear that song. Please make it stop. Please just stop it. They walk in. Then it's the wedding march, and the bride comes in. We all stand up. There's a short prayer. Everyone sits down. A few more words, another prayer, then some kind of sermon. And the sermon is almost always, at least here in Oklahoma, just oozing in Bible verses. And it's stuff you and I can mostly recite from memory. You know, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord, as told to us in Proverbs chapter 18. Over all these virtues, put on love, Colossians 3:14. Two are better than one. The Lord God said, it's not good for the man to be alone. I will make a suitable helper for him. The ring is a symbol. It has no beginning and no end. Like the love of our Savior for us, and like the love that we should have for each other. And of course, they have to read from 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. Love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, blah, 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 blah. Love never fails. And then there's special music. And this might be a hymn or a spiritual song. Quite often I'll hear something like Stephen Curtis Chapman's I Will Be Here, which was a song I'm sure written for weddings. We hear a ton of Shania Twain. I mean, I don't know how many weddings I've been sitting there, and they'll go and light the unity candle, or they'll kneel for communion or for whatever, and someone goes up, and it's over and over. From this moment, I have been blessed. I live only for your happiness. Make it stop. Make it stop already. Can't take it. Or Dan Fogelberg. you know, longer than there have been fishes in the ocean. I don't know how many times I've heard that song at a wedding. Higher than any bird ever flew. Please, somebody do something original. Please. And then there's the final vows or whatever, exchange of the rings. There's a kiss. Everybody applauds. They walk out to more music, and then we all go eat, okay? I like the weddings that are unique, that are really about the couple. The most excruciating weddings are the ones where people are building a religious soapbox on the occasion of the matrimony of this man and woman. And that's what happened a few weeks ago, and I almost came out of my chair. Here's the story. We're all sitting in there. It's a beautiful place. Decorated beautifully. It's all put together. Must have been 130 or 140 people there. I mean, it's a full house. I don't know the bride and groom hardly. In fact, I'd never met the groom and I barely knew the bride, but you know, I knew her casually. It's her day. Great. Glad to be here. You celebrate, commemorate the day any way you want. Knock yourself out. And I had heard that they were both fundamental Christians, like devout Bible literalist Sunday go to meet and Jesus is in my heart Christians. So I was preparing myself because I figured it's going to be a devoutly Christian ceremony. Fine, whatever. It is what it is. So I'm sitting out here and the service starts. Now the pastor starts to speak, but he's not speaking to the couple. He's speaking to all of us in the auditorium. He's speaking to the 130 people sitting in the chairs beyond the bride and groom. And he says, all of you here have a very important role to play. You have three special things that you have been charged by God to do. And it's got my curiosity, right? Three things. I wonder what those are. The first thing is that you are to be witnesses today, witnesses to this union between a man and a woman under God in holy matrimony. All right, fine. The second thing that you are charged to do is to encourage, to support this couple in the good times and the bad. All right, fine. We're supposed to witness and we're supposed to encourage. And the third thing that all of you have been charged by God to do and is your responsibility is to, when necessary, rebuke this couple. Excuse me? Whenever they stray from the fold, whenever you see them in sin, whenever you see them acting in a way that is, I don't know exactly how he phrased it, but you're not spiritually in tune. Everybody in the audience is supposed to rebuke them. Like church discipline. Like he was placing on our shoulders the right and responsibility to sort of peer in their windows and tell them when they're not acting right. And I could feel the hair on the back of my neck start to stand up. Now, I'm sure that Natalie at this moment is hearing my voice in her head. As I'm thinking, what business is it of ours to go and tell these two people how to live? And why are you giving 130 people, many of whom are relative strangers, permission to interject themselves into the personal lives of this married couple? I calm myself and the service continues. Now, he focuses for just a second on the groom. Starts talking about the man. He says, now I have known him for 10 years or whatever. And he's 35 years old, and he's never been married. And I remember one of the long conversations we had together. I said to him, why is it that you have never taken a wife? If you go this long and you haven't found a bride, well, there's obvious reason for concern. I'm in the audience, and I'm thinking, no, there's not. What business is it of yours if he decides to get married at 25 or 55? But I hold my tongue. But then I met the bride-to-be, and I realized that God had been saving him, blah, 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 blah. Fine. Now, that's the brief moment that he spoke about the groom. He didn't spend any time talking about his obligations or responsibilities, his opportunities as a life partner and husband, and what their lives might be like together. Didn't spend any time talking about him as a man. Nothing. He just bounced off the fact that he'd been concerned that a 35-year-old man had not yet exchanged the ring with somebody But whew, wow, finally he's here and it was worth the wait. Okay, fine. We move to the bride. He spends 10 minutes talking about the bride and it goes something like this. Now, some people at wedding ceremonies are afraid of the S word. But here we're not afraid of the S word when it comes to biblical matrimony. Anyone know what the S word is? Of course, all of us in the audience are going through the mental Rolodex, probably starting with sex. What's the S word? The S word is submission. Now I can feel the color of my face starting to change. The Bible says that the woman came from man. She came from his rib and was created as a helpmate to submit and serve the man. The man will be the head of your household. He will be the final word, and it is your spiritual responsibility to submit to your husband. And there was a part of me as I was sitting there that was fantasizing that this bride-to-be would look that pastor right in the face and say, "Kiss my ass, I'm not going to submit. Hell no, I'm not going to submit. We'll be life partners. We'll share decisions. We'll speak and live as equals. I'm not going to submit simply because he has a penis. I'm not doing it." I was fantasizing that she would do this. Instead, she just lovingly gazes up at her groom and back at the pastor and says, I will submit. Now, I'm watching people in the audience right now, and I'm thinking, what's the temperature out here? And I'm not making this up. I figure 30 to 40% of the people, I just couldn't read. There were a few people who nodded, women who were nodding. Yes, good for you. Praise the Lord. Praise Jesus. Going to submit. Submit to your husband because that's the model that Jesus has prepared for you. Amen. And then there were some other people, some women, quite a few, who literally, I think, were laughing under their breath and whispering to their husbands, like, "I'd like to see that pastor try that shit with me." Some groomsman comes up. I don't know if he's not the best man, but he comes up and he gives a prayer. One of the most awkward prayers I have ever heard. His prayer essentially was, "Lord, we know that we're all sinners and unworthy. We all deserve hell, Lord. We all deserve punishment. And yet you came and died on the cross for us. And we know that we're all going to be tempted in our lives. We're all going to be tempted to stray." Now, I'm thinking, wait a minute. Did you just, during the prayer, insinuate that these two will be tempted to have an affair, and you're praying that they will have the wherewithal to be able to resist the temptation? And is this appropriate on their wedding day? Lord, we know that whenever they have the urge to cheat,
if you know what I mean,
yeah, they're going to get bored with each other and they're going to see someone else who's really attractive and they're going to want to, you know. We ask that you give them divine willpower so that they can resist. It was just bizarre. I mean, it's not what he said, but that was the vibe of the prayer. And after it was over, Natalie and I looked at each other. In fact, several people on our row were like, "Didn't he just pray that they wouldn't cheat on each other?" Bizarre. At the end of that, everybody congratulates the bride and groom, and they walk out to applause, and the music plays, and people are saying to themselves, probably, "What a beautiful ceremony." In fact, I think the father of the bride actually publicly at the reception thanked the pastor. "Thank you for such a heartfelt and beautiful ceremony." I was thinking the exact opposite. I was thinking, you crossed so many boundaries and promoted so many shitty ideas during that 25 minutes, you should be publicly rebuked. Essentially declaring that if you're not married, especially by a certain year of your life, you're living wrong, you're doing it wrong, you're broken in some way. Declaring that a woman has to roll over and submit simply because she's a woman. Giving permission to 100+ outsiders, each who have their own subjective perspectives and opinions about what is spiritually right and wrong. Giving them permission to peer in somebody else's windows and meddle in their personal lives, in their married lives, and coloring the entire ceremony with the idea that none of us are worthy of happiness anyway, and only from this divine wizard who's up there looking at us from on high can we experience any goodness. It was just tragic. It was tragic. I left that wedding and I was just coiled up like a spring. I was so tense and I was so irritated. And I was reminded of the subtitle of Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And I take an issue with the idea that religion always poisons everything. Like, there are some things that religion can do or has done that might have, in a certain context, brought benefit. I don't know. It's hard to even say it out loud. I don't even know if I believe it. But I just thought, I'm not sure that religion poisons everything. But I left the wedding and I thought, religion poisons everything. This wedding should have been just a celebration, two people getting together to bond their lives together, to frame it however they wish. Instead, it ends up being some weird reflection of ancient holy texts that say that if you don't live and act like this, you're doing it wrong. Does religion poison everything? Is there any instance where if we were to remove religion from the equation, it would be worse off? Because I think to myself, you can have tradition. You know, you can have the music, you can have the decor, you can have the dress, you can have the practices, you can do so many of these things, traditional things, without the superstitious undertones and overtones, without the bad ideas. You can have structure without the religion, and it's, I think, in every case, better, isn't it? Religion really does poison everything, does it not? Or does it? You're going to hear many of Christopher Hitchens' words and thoughts and ideas throughout the rest of this broadcast. I figure if I want to borrow the subtitle of his book, I should certainly give credit where it's due. And I just enjoy playing stuff from Christopher Hitchens. I enjoy listening to the sound of his voice. I enjoy the way he spoke and wrote. And, you know, referring back to my story about the wedding, it's amazing how much of what was said and the attitudes presented really were those of slaves. People who were gleefully embracing their own lack of self-worth, their own dependence on masters, their own submission to authority, with a capital A, and their own desire to be slaves. Here's Christopher Hitchens from a presentation he gave at Google back in 2007.
I think there's the real temptation of something very poisonous to human society and human relations, which is the fear of freedom, the wish to be slaves, the wish to be told what to do. Now, just as we all like to think, and we live under written documents and proclamations that encourage us to think that it is our birthright and our most precious need to be free, to be liberated, to be untrammeled. So we also know that, unfortunately, the innate in people is the servile, is the wish to be told what to do, is the adoration for strong and brutal and cruel leaders. This other baser element of the human makeup has to be accounted for and gives us a great deal of trouble around the world as we speak. Religion, in my view, is a reification, a distillation of this wish to be a serf, to be a slave.
In his 2007 book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, in the chapter called A Note on Health, Hitchens talked about the apostate and the apostate recounting his or her experiences within religious thinking. The paragraph says this: a special subgenre of modern literature is the memoir of a man or woman who once underwent a religious education. The modern world is now sufficiently secular for some of these authors to attempt to be funny about what they underwent and what they were expected to believe. However, such books tend necessarily to be written by those with enough fortitude to have survived the experience. We have no way to quantify the damage done by telling millions of children that masturbation will make them blind, or that impure thoughts will lead to an eternity of torment, or that members of other faiths, including members of their own families, will burn, or that venereal disease will result from kisses. Nor can we hope to quantify the damage done by holy instructors who rammed home these lies and accompanied them with floggings and rapes and public humiliations. Some of those who, quote, rest in unvisited tombs may have contributed to the good of the world, but those who preached hatred and fear and guilt and who ruined innumerable childhoods should have been thankful that the hell they preached was only one among their wicked falsifications and that they were not sent to rot there. That certainly sounds like Christopher Hitchens. Let's go to the switchboard. I've got Brandon on Skype. Brandon, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. How are you doing, Seth?
You a Hitchens fan, Brandon?
A little bit of Hitchens I've read into. Really, I'm more of a Pendulette guy. He's the one who really kind of kicked me in the butt.
Brandon, what do you think about religion and the subtitle of Hitchens' book? Does religion poison everything? What do you think?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it poisons everything. There's good that can come from religion, and there's bad that can come from religion. The problem, however, is that both the good and the bad that comes from religion come from an irrational or illogical perspective. And whenever you're relying on irrational to motivate you, the problems that come with it can be even harder to overcome, whereas the good things – that's not so much a problem because they're good things, but the problems, they're harder to fix whenever from an irrational perspective.
Give me an example of what you think is a good thing. Like, what good does religion itself do from your perspective?
Even though people kind of do feel compelled to go to church for God, it really is a good way for communities or for people to socialize with one another. Many churches do charities where it's not all about proselytizing. They may throw something in there about God. And, hey, this is from our church. If you want more about God, you know, talk to us. But, you know, some of them do actually do charities that help people, or they'll do fundraisers, or somebody in a church is having a surgery or something. You know, sometimes they'll ask church members to throw in some money for that member.
I appreciate you saying that, because there's this misconception out there that all churches are corrupt and all churches are passing the plate just because they want to get rich. And pastors love lying to people and they only take mission trips because they seek converts, but not because they genuinely care. Now, granted, the God backstory does sort of taint these experiences, but there are a lot of truly loving and compassionate and good people inside the church and inside the church model, inside religion, who are genuinely trying to make the world a better place. We just think that they're latched on to some unfortunate and debunked ideas. Would that be an accurate way to say that? I want to put words in your mouth, Brandon.
No,
that's accurate?
That's about right. They do, a lot of people out there, I think it's fair to say most people do come from a good place, which is unfortunate whenever they do latch on to something that is harmful view.
But if we're saying outright, you and me, we're saying we could remove the religion and it would be better.
I think that without the religion, it's more than possible to replace the benefits of religion through secular means.
Final thoughts to add before I move on, Brandon, about religion itself? I mean, does it make you angry? Are you passive about it? What do you think?
I guess it really just kind of depends on the circumstances, really. Ultimately, I'd like to encourage people to question religion. I don't like to go, you believe what you want to believe, and I'll believe what I want to believe. I'm very outspoken. I think we should question everything, but my feelings towards religion really is circumstantial.
Fair enough, my friend. Thanks for being a part of the broadcast and for lending your voice to the conversation. Greatly appreciated.
I appreciate being on the show, Seth.
Religion makes the following appeal to us, which is why I say it poisons everything, because it goes to the deep nature of our self-respect and our humanity and our integrity. It makes the following bid to us. It says, you are born sinful. You're born guilty. You're guilty of crimes that were committed before you were born. You are not able to evade them. Your sin is original. You're made from dust, or in the Quran, from a clot of blood. Your creator is not in a very good mood with you, and there's no reason why he should be, given what a piece of excrement you basically are. That's the masochistic element of it. But after this thoroughgoing abjection, thoroughgoing demand that you throw aside all your self-respect, you're told there is, however, some redeeming news. The universe is designed with you in mind. The cosmos cares what happens to you. And if you will continue to abject yourself like a serf in front of God. You may hope for the forgiveness of sins, for eternal life, and for a divine plan. In other words, the maximum appeal to the abject, the servile in you, and the maximum appeal to the self-centered and the egomaniac. Not a very wholesome way to begin a discussion about the main questions, such as why are we here, who are we, what are we here for, what is the just city, how would it look like, what is the meaning of life. It's begun by a horrible lecture from a dictator. And you're then further told that if you do not bow the knee to a celestial dictatorship, unalterable, unchangeable, unappealable to, if you don't believe in that, you would have no means of telling right from wrong. How would you know how to do the right thing or avoid the wrong if you were not being told by a celestial dictatorship? Once again, an absolutely central attack on any concept that we might have of our own integrity, dignity, and self-respect. How would Huck Finn know? Admittedly, he's a fictional character, but then so are most of the people I'm going to be discussing from Moses onwards. How does Huck Finn know that he's not to betray his friend Jim? He's not to give him back. He's not to give him up to the people who are hunting for him. How does Mark Twain know that we will like Huck when he refuses this? What does Huck know? The law is against him. The church is against him. All the preachments of religion and customary law are against him. He thinks that if he refuses the demand to give up his slave friend, he's going to go straight to hell. That's what he thinks, but he still does the right thing, as we might all hope to do, as we must all hope to do, if we were tested much less than that. It's innate in us. Religion gets its morals from us. We know what the right thing is without being told by a celestial dictatorship.
I put the question out on social media, does religion poison everything, expecting a wide variety of responses, and instead I got mostly responses in the affirmative. Does religion poison everything? Michael says, yes. Yes, it does. Matthew said, it's a factor in how I lived my life, how I reacted to people and talked to them for years, and in some ways still does residually. Ashley said, I've had discussions with my atheist boyfriend about the harm religion does. He plays devil's advocate and says religion is only harmful in the hands of people who have mental problems already and would still do crazy things even without religion. I don't entirely agree with him because strong religious convictions can cause otherwise rational people to do crazy things. I use the Catholic Church as a good example of this. Yes, they do good, charitable things, but are the good things they do enough to outweigh the fact that children are being sexually abused by priests and condoms and birth control are being withheld from those that desperately need it? I personally think humanity would be better off without religion. Tommy decided to go deeper into the question. He said, playing the Dillahunty role, that depends on what you mean by poison and what you mean by everything. We try to avoid being hyperbolic. Religion has been very beneficial for many to break a drug habit or make a lot of money. Religion has provided many with comfort in stress and grief. Is religion the only means for this? Nope. Does religion cause more bad than good? Maybe, probably. Does being more specific and accurate with our language, especially in discussions about worldviews, lead to more productive conversation? Definitely. Paul said, it's insidious. It's been poisoning everything. From education to healthcare to birth control to sex ed to women's rights, it's been steadily getting worse in this country, in the U.S., and is threatening areas of our Constitution. Marcus said, I rarely deal in absolutes. Many things, yes. Everything, probably not. And for those who wonder if we're going to speak only about Christianity when we speak about religion, here's Christopher Hitchens on Islam from 2007.
Now, let's not dance around. Not all monotheisms are exactly the same at the moment. They're all based on the same illusion. They're all plagiarisms of each other. But there's one in particular that at the moment is posing a serious menace, not just to freedom of speech and freedom of expression, but to quite a lot of other freedoms too. And this is the religion that exhibits the horrible trio of self-hatred, self-righteousness and self-pity. I'm talking about militant Islam. Globally, it's a gigantic power. Globally, it's a gigantic power. It controls an enormous amount of oil wealth, several large countries and states, with an enormous fortune. It's pumping the ideology of Wahhabism and Salafism around the world, poisoning societies where it goes, ruining the minds of children, stultifying the young in its madrasas, training people in violence, making a cult of death and suicide and murder. That's what it does globally. It's quite strong. In our societies, it poses as a cringing minority whose faith you might offend, which deserves all the protection that a small and vulnerable group might need. Now, it makes quite large claims for itself, doesn't it? It says it's the final revelation. It says that God spoke to one illiterate businessman in the Arabian Peninsula three times through an archangel, and that the resulting material, which as you can see when you read it, is largely plagiarized from the Old and the New Testament. Almost all of it actually plagiarized ineptly from the Old and New Testament, is to be accepted as a divine revelation and as the final and unalterable one, and that those who do not accept this revelation are fit to be treated as cattle, infidels, potential chattel, slaves, and victims. Well, I tell you what, I don't think Muhammad ever heard those voices. I don't believe it. And the likelihood that I'm right, as opposed to the likelihood that a shepherd who couldn't, a businessman couldn't, who couldn't read, had bits of the Old and New Testament redictated to him by an archangel, I think puts me much more near the position of being objectively correct. But who is the one under threat? The person who promulgates this and says, I'd better listen because if I don't, I'm in danger? Or me, who says, no, I think this is so silly you could even publish a cartoon about it. And up go the placards, and up go the yells and the howls and the screams. Behead those. This is in London. This is in Toronto. This is in New York. It's right in our midst now. Behead those. Behead those who cartoon Islam. Do they get arrested for hate speech? No. Might I get in trouble for saying what I've just said about the Prophet Muhammad? Yes, I might. Where are your priorities, ladies and gentlemen? You're giving away what's most precious in your own society, and you're giving it away without a fight, and you're even praising the people who want to deny you the right to resist it. Shame on you while you do this. Make the best use of the time you've got left. This is really serious.
I've got Sonia on Skype. Sonia, you are on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm well. Does religion poison everything? What do you think?
Yes, it does. I know that for me, it's all about punishment and no love and peace at all.
Well, not all religion is like that, though. Tell me what your experience personally was. Was it all stick, no carrot kind of thing, or what happened?
Mostly, well, what really, I'm still bitter about it. Like growing up in French Canada, we had catechism class in public schools, and it was only abandoned in grade 10 when the Jehovah's Witnesses finally complained. So it was a big uproar because they couldn't have religions in schools anymore. But I remember the poor kids who happened to be Jehovah's Witnesses who had to leave class whenever we had catechism, and I thought they were really lucky, but they got teased and bullied relentlessly because they belonged to the wrong church.
Interesting that the Jehovah's Witnesses did for you what the Satanic Temple is doing in the United States. There's one religion that's sort of declaring itself a monopoly religion, and another religion says, hey, we get equal time or none, and so they have to shut things down.
Yeah, and they, like the Jehovah's Witnesses, get seen on the same level as the Satanic Temple, because I remember I talked about this with my mother a couple of months ago, and she is still bitter that the Jehovah's Witnesses took religions away from her.
We talk about those who are angry about their own childhood or other indoctrination. And sometimes I look and I think, you got a damn good reason to be angry. Are you angry?
Well, I'm mostly bitter because I see how, like, in school, it's like I see religion as, like, it was a stick that we beat each other up with at school. And I know I had friends who were from a different religions because she liked to dance, but I got like pushed aside and said, like, you know, Sonia, you shouldn't, like, she's not good association because she's a fundamentalist. But for me, she was this cool girl who liked to dance like I did. I was never religious. And even like in grade one, the priest came in and he brought the Bible and he put it on a desk or something. And we had to kiss the Bible. And being me, I raised my hand and said, why do we have to kiss the Bible? And his reply was, just kiss the Bible. And
wait. Sonia, hang on. You had to literally reach over, reach down, kiss the Bible?
Yes.
How many people were pressing their lips against this book at any one time?
It was like 25.
Like a communicable disease going on there.
Yeah. Oh, it was before flu season.
Oh, that's good to know. That's good to know. Well, it's just such an odd visual I have in my mind. You know, you walk in and it's like kissing the ring or something else. It's bizarre.
It was normal. That's how it was.
Do you suffer from any sort of familial consequence in your own life, or do they know yet?
They don't know. Like, before becoming an atheist, I was a Wiccan for 20 years. I was a witch for 20 years before sure. I saw the light. But two of my sisters knew I was Wiccan.
Well, how'd that go over in a Catholic family? They must have flipped out.
Well, my sisters were okay. They asked weird questions, but they... Like, if my mother knew, I probably would have been burnt at the stake. But but it's funny, instead of having all my Wiccan books hidden away so nobody sees them when they visit, I have all my Hitchin books and your books and hidden in the cupboard so they don't happen to see it by chance.
Hopefully they won't go fishing around, right, and checking out the...
If they find it, you know, they shouldn't be looking over there. It's
their own damn fault, people.
Yeah. But I know, like, I was afraid. We had a big ice storm in January. Like, we were without power for, like, 13 days, and, like, four people died, and, like, it was horrible. And... finally get power again, and my mother, okay, like, you know, let's pray to God for this meal. I said, God didn't prepare this meal. You know, we picked it up at the grocery stores. He had the farmers, and we made the meal. And she says, no, without God, none of this would be possible. And then I start again, and she just, you just don't believe in anything, Sonia. You know, and I said, I believed in humanity, but then I thought I was found out, but apparently I'm safe.
I would think she'd have her suspicions if if you had that conversation. Certainly the writing was on the wall, right?
Well, she has her suspicions, but, you know, it's like her need to believe is so strong that she refuses to see it because it's so important to her. I guess it's a good thing for me, but it's getting harder and harder to keep it in.
Yeah.
Because it's so important. It's such a good part of my life. And she keeps telling me, you know, what a great person I am and this and that. But whenever there's hints that I, you know, God is not in my life, then I'm the devil.
You think your family would be better off without religion? You think the world would be better off without religion?
Yes, because I know, like, my dad, like, he's now deceased, but the nuns and priests in school, they would, like, give him the strap because he was left-handed, and that's of the devil.
I had never heard that until, I think, last year, the idea that if you were left-handed, you were somehow in league with Lucifer or tainted by the devil. I'd never heard such a thing, but I guess it's common.
Yes, and it's so insidious. Here, it's like, you know, I thought I was safe speaking out, but it's not like in the States where, like, you have, like, the Christian flag and, like, in God we trust. Like, you guys are so flashy in the States. But no, in Canada, like, people are quietly devout, which is even more sketchy because you think you're safe, but you're not.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've had discussions with friends my age. I'm like, I'm 4 years younger than you. And I thought we were on the same page, but turns out that their Catholic cultural identity is still very important, even though they don't go to church. And that's the thing I see here. It's been beaten out of us, and they can't fathom you being of a different religion or changing your mind. That just, you can't do that. It's unthinkable.
Well, we haven't. I haven't accidentally outed you on the radio here, right? I mean, there's no crossover. There's none of them are listening,
well,
right?
If they find me out through you, they deserve to know.
All right. Well, they might secretly be an atheist as well if they're listening here. Who really knows? So, Sonia, thank you so much for your perspective, for listening. Well, you hang in there, and hopefully we'll get a chance to shake hands in person next time I'm up. Where about in Canada roughly are you?
In New Brunswick. Okay. It's like three provinces away from Ontario.
Well, I'm going to Toronto here in, I think, a month and a half, but I'm not going to be in your neck of the woods. But perhaps next time, okay?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Sonia. Greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm going to play some more Christopher Hitchens right after the break. And I'm going to read from his book. I'm also talking to David Silverman. He is the president of American Atheist. He wrote a book called Fighting God. Oh, I can already hear the answer to the question, does religion poison everything, when presented to him, but we're going to hear it straight from the horse's mouth on the other side of this. Hang on. Don't forget my supporters on Patreon. Get a completely commercial-free version of the broadcast and a bonus show every single month. And you can choose the model for your support, $1 a month or whatever. And thank you so much for that. You can go to patreon.com/SethAndrews. I borrowed the subtitle from Christopher Hitchens' 2007 book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, to have the conversation about whether or not you agree. Do you think religion does poison everything, every time, all the time, in every way? Here's Christopher Hitchens speaking at Google. I believe this is in 2007, when he was speaking about a test that he had been giving for those who claim that religion has a monopoly on morality.
Here's my challenge. You have to name me an ethical statement that was made or a moral action that was performed by a religious person in the name of faith that could not have been made as an action or uttered as a statement by a person not of faith, a person of no faith. You have to do that. Not so far, and I've done it at quite a high level with the religious, no takers. No one's been able to find me that. That being the case, we're entitled to say, I think, that religious faith is surplus to requirements. Whereas, if I was to ask anyone in this room, think of a wicked thing said or an evil thing done by a person of faith in the name of faith, no one would have a second of hesitation in thinking of one, would they?
From God Is Not Great, chapter 13, start on page 184. The argument that religious belief improves people, or that it helps to civilize society, is one that people tend to bring up when they've exhausted the rest of their case. Very well, they seem to say, we cease to insist on the Exodus, or the virgin birth, or even the resurrection, or the night flight from Mecca to Jerusalem. But where would people be without faith? Would they not abandon themselves to every kind of license and selfishness? Is it not true, as G.K. Chesterton once famously said, that if people cease to believe in God, they do not believe in nothing, but in anything? The first thing to be said is that virtuous behavior by a believer is no proof at all of, indeed not even an argument for, the truth of his belief. I might, just for the sake of argument, act more charitably if I believed that Lord Buddha was born from a slit in his mother's side. But would not this make my charitable impulse dependent upon something rather tenuous? By the same token, I do not say that if I catch a Buddhist priest stealing all the offerings left by the simple folk at his temple. Buddhism is thereby discredited. And lest we forget in any case how contingent all this is. Of the thousands of possible desert religions there were, as with the millions of potential species there were, one branch happened to take root and grow. Passing through its Jewish mutations to its Christian form, it was eventually adopted for political reasons by the Emperor Constantine and made into an official faith with, eventually, a codified and enforceable form of its many chaotic and contradictory books. As for Islam, it became the ideology of a highly successful conquest that was adopted by successful ruling dynasties, codified and set down in its turn, and promulgated as the law of the land. One or two military victories the other way, and we in the West would not be the hostages of village disputes that took place in Judea and Arabia before any serious records were kept. We could have become the votaries of another belief altogether, perhaps a Hindu or an Aztec or a Confucian one, in which case we should still be told that, strictly true or not, it nonetheless helped teach the children the difference between right and wrong. In other words, to believe in a God is in one way to express a willingness to believe in anything, whereas to reject the belief is by no means to profess belief in nothing. Joining me next on the broadcast is someone I knew would have an opinion about religion, despite the fact that he is such a wallflower and never speaks his mind. He's the president of American Atheist. He is an author and activist. His name is David Silverman. David, how's it going, man?
Oh, I'm doing great, Seth. Thank you so much for having me back on the show.
Before we get into the, is religion always poisonous? Right? Hitchens used to say, does religion poison everything? Before I get into that, you know, we had spoken on the recent show about Madeleine Murray O'Hare. And since I have you here, I have to talk about the Netflix movie. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but you saw the movie. I was kind of hoping to find out what your take on it was.
I think you said it best. It's an opportunity lost. It was really a good opportunity to highlight the hero that Madeleine was and the sacrifices that she made. And instead, they chose to dramatize the murder, but also dramatize her life and her personality. And I really felt that they could have done her much better. You know, one of the things that I think very strongly, Seth, is that Madeleine Murray O'Hara was a hero, an actual real life hero, somebody who sacrificed her life and her well-being for the good of all people. And it wasn't just for atheists that she sacrificed. She helped the Jews and the Muslims and the Mormons and even the Christians as well. All those children are now living in a freer society because Madeleine Murray O'Hare did something that literally no one else had done, literally no one else would do, which would be attack the separation of church and state issue as an atheist, as an outsider of religion. And I think that the Netflix movie painted her in a pretty bad light. I think they really did her memory a disservice when they painted her as a somewhat ugly person, a somewhat nasty person.
Well, you know, we're watching the film. I thought, I'm watching someone, but I don't feel like I'm watching Madeleine Murray O'Hare. Like I see a character, but I don't see Madeleine here on screen at all.
No. And you know what? Madeleine was a staunch opponent of religion. She was hard and she was brazen and she was brave and she was fearless and she was intelligent. And none of that comes through. A lot of atheists, a lot of believers rather, hate atheists because we say the things that aren't supposed to be said about their religion. And Madeleine was the first one to do that. Madeleine was the premier religion basher, the first real religion basher, the first person who would stand up and say, religion is a con, religion is a lie, religion is a scam. And this is the person on whose giant shoulders I stand. And I think that that really fell flat.
Yeah.
I think that really was completely, not fell flat, I think it was ignored.
Well, I knew you have a perspective on it, Dave. I mean, I knew it. I mean, I knew by asking the current president of American Atheist about the organization she founded. Didn't mean to, I don't want to go too far off the bunny trail, but I thought, you know, what a great opportunity to talk to Dave Silverman about his perspective. We're talking about religion. Does it poison everything? And, you know, you're out there on the front lines swinging for the fences. You're out there having some often very unpopular conversations yourself. You often sit in the hot seat on Fox News and elsewhere. Does religion poison everything? David Silverman, what do you think?
Religion poisons everything. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind religion poisons everything. And I'll tell you why. There's a very real reason why religion poisons everything, and that is that religion is a lie. Religion is a con. Religion is a scam. Religion, when I talk about religion, I'm talking about, and just to make sure that my definitions are correct, okay, a god is a living supernatural consciousness, and a religion is the practice of worshiping and or celebrating that god. So by the definitions that I'm using for this conversation, there is no such thing as a secular or non-theistic religion. Religion, by definition, includes a god. And guess what? Gods don't exist. Gods are lies. So when you've got a thing, and just take a thing, and you add in a lie, how does that make it better?
It makes them feel better, David. You know, it makes them happy, gives them warm fuzzies, you know, come on.
Yeah. But why does it give them warm fuzzies? It gives them warm fuzzies because religion was there in the first place to tell them that they needed warm fuzzies, needed religion to get warm fuzzies. I get lots of warm fuzzies. I'm a very warm and fuzzy person. I am a nice guy.
Yeah.
But that's the point. You know, all joking aside, the reason people think they need religion is because religion tells them that they need religion. The reason people get warm fuzzies from religion is because they're indoctrinated to feel the warm fuzzies from religion. No, that's not okay. It's no better than saying, oh, well, heroin makes people feel good. Sure, heroin makes people feel good, but it's still something that will stand in the way of a person from expanding. It'll stand in the way of a person from living. And that's not good. And when we're talking about religion, sure, religion makes people happy if they've been indoctrinated into thinking that it makes them happy. It also makes them moral if they've been indoctrinated into thinking that religion makes them moral. No, there is no need for religion in today's society. There is no need and there is no benefit to society to have an organized system of lies by which people can use to control other people. We're talking about preachers controlling other people en masse with a lie and then – oh, but it makes them feel good. And defending that with, oh, it makes the people feel good. Well, guess what? It may make them feel good a little bit in the short term, but in the long term, it poisons our society. In the long term, it takes money from individuals, power from individuals, and funnels it to dishonest people who claim to talk, some dishonest people or misled people who claim to talk of their God. We're talking about a system of lies that has been honed over thousands of years to be really effective at channeling power from the masses to the few. Now, I was in China a few months ago, and I said something that really got a stir from them, and that was that Mao Zedong didn't go far enough, and he didn't. Mao Zedong said that religion funnels power from the masses to the few, and that's why religion is the enemy of the people. But it has to go farther than that. It has to go into numerology. It has to go into skeptical thinking. It has to go into astrology. And all of those things poison our society. The lack of skepticism poisons our society. It poisons everything that we do. And it's not just religion. It is astrology. It is homeopathy. It is every scam out there, one of which is religion. And religion is absolutely positively no better than any of the other scams out there. No better than homeopathy, no better than astrology, no better than any crap that I can just make up right here. It's a lie and it's a scam, and no, it has no purpose in society today.
You're in the point position there at American Atheists. You've seen sort of this sea change, or at least a revelation of a portion of America that we didn't really see before, with the Trump administration coming into power, sort of an anti-science culture. We're seeing the evangelicals feeling empowered in many ways, some people calling Trump God's will. You tell me, are things better or are they worse now than they were, say, a couple of years ago? I mean, what's your take?
Well, things are certainly more difficult. Our job at American Atheists got more challenging. Our jobs at American Atheists got more dangerous. Our jobs at American Atheists got longer term when Mr. Trump became president. We've seen an increase in hate. We've seen an increase in nastiness. We've seen an increase in threats. But we've also seen an increase in membership and an increase in donations and an increase in support from our base. So I'm reminded of George W. Bush when he was first elected. Back in 9/11, I was volunteering for American Atheists during 9/11, and 9/11, of course, made the world a worse place. but American atheists and the actual atheist movement bettered for it. So that's a silver lining.
Now, why is that? Is it because people saw the attack and the response and thought religion's the problem, not the solution? Or I mean, what drove it?
Yeah, well, back then it was overwhelmingly George W. Bush saying we are a Christian nation and God is on our side in the face of God attacking us on their side. You know, of course, Seth, you know that all religion is individual. Everybody agrees with their God. Yeah. Nobody on the planet has a God that disagrees with them. And so when people were seeing, oh, 9/11 happened, and it was all of a sudden, it was our God versus their God. That's a very scary thing for an atheist to see. That's a very scary thing for an atheist to hear, because when it's our God versus their God, that's two sides that are against us. And it scared a bunch of people then, and I think it's scaring a bunch of people now to see the evangelicals in what I hope and expect is their last throes of power, to be able to take power from us like this and to take power and take hold of America.
What, do you think you're going to see a pendulum swing back the other way? You think we're going to wake up a little bit?
Yeah. I definitely do think this is going to be a pendulum swing. I definitely think that we need to focus very heavily on the 2018 and even more so in the 2020 election. Nothing is reversible. And this is something that I have said a few times. A lot of people are very doom and gloomy right now. A lot of atheists are very doom and gloomy. We've lost. We've given up. We can't win. They're going to keep the Senate. They're going to keep the House. Now the Gorsuch is in the Supreme Court. It's all over. It's all over. And folks, it is not over. It is not over. We are not out of this fight. We have a lot of room. We have a lot of strength. And we have a lot of time in front of us to go and undo all the stuff that President Trump is doing. And yeah, he's doing some long-term damage. But he'll be out in 4 years. We'll be back in 4 years. And we'll be in power, hopefully, in 2 years. And I don't have really much hesitation at all in saying that not only is the pendulum going to swing back, it's going to swing back farther than it was before. I think we're going to see people waking up and seeing not only that the evangelicals are bad for this country, but that they're hypocrites. And, you know, when we saw a good example is that before President Trump was elected, there was a protest at Liberty University protesting Liberty's endorsement of Donald Trump because of ethics. That's Christian students. And so when President Trump fails and goes down in flames, the people who are inside Christianity, who are right now closeted, but there's a lot of them, they're right now closeted because the Christian majority is in power. But once Trump is toppled, once Trump goes down one way or another, they will be able to look at their own religion and see it for the sham that it is, see it for the scam that it is, and see it for the hypocrisy that it represents. And I think what we're going to see is an even bigger push away from religion as a result of President Trump. I think we're going to see, it's going to be a few years, but I think we're going to see a bigger push away. I think now is a very important and awesome time to become an atheist activist and a supporter of atheist activism. I got to say, people, when we're done, you're going to sit back and you're going to be happy that the fight was hard. And this fight is going to be hard. And there's going to be a lot of yelling and there's going to be a lot of screaming and there's going to be a lot of hurt feelings. But guess what? This is worth the fight. This country is worth the fight. Our principles and our freedom and our children's freedom is worth the fight. And I think that when the dust settles, we will sit back and look at the victory that we will obtain, and we will be happy with ourselves for having participated in a very righteous fight.
David Silverman, president of American Atheist. How's the convention prep coming? You guys have the big thing coming up in August, and it's awesome that you've scheduled it on top of the solar eclipse, because you know there's a shit ton of people all around the country who can be like, you know, all these atheists gathered and we lost the sun, right? What more proof do you need? But how's it?
You know, I do like the press around the atheists celebrating the total eclipse of the sun. And that is one of the reasons that we did it. But mostly, you know, when I first got into atheist activism, I got in for the issues, but I stayed in for the people. I love the people at atheist conventions, and I love the people at American Atheist National Conventions. And that's the reason that I've been in this movement now for 20-odd years, because of the people. And these conventions are fun above all else. This is why the conventions that we put on at American Atheists are fun, and that's why I wanted to make it at the solar eclipse, so that atheists can get together and socialize around a total eclipse of the sun. And James Randi is going to be there, and Ian Harris is going to be there, and we're going to have Yvette Jatremont is there as well. We're going to have more scientists coming up to be announced soon. who will be there to narrate the total eclipse of the sun. I mean, how many times do you get to see a total eclipse and do it with a bunch of atheists? It's going to be fantastic.
That's
for those of people who were around in Memphis for our epic convention in Memphis. Trace and Frank, Mystery Science Theater's Mads, are coming back, and they will be redoing, or I should say, they will be riffing on God's Not Dead 2, which is going to be a lot of fun. it's going to be. Oh, and we have a new guest. I can actually announce somebody. Also attending the American Atheist National Convention will be Alan Cooperman, the director of religion research at the Pew Research Center.
Wow.
He will be coming to talk about how religion is growing, or I should say how religion is shrinking and how atheism is growing. Also coming is Annie Pearl Avery, a civil rights activist from the 60s, the only person arrested in Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama in 1965. Annie Pearl is an atheist. And she's coming to the convention.
Wow.
And she's going to talk about civil rights back in the 60s and how it was like to be an atheist back then. The tickets are on sale at atheists.org/convention2017. And please go in there and check it out quickly, because it looks pretty good. We're selling quickly. We got plenty of time. It's not about to sell out. But please book your hotel rooms. I will say that we have already needed to increase our hotel room block. It's April. The thing is not for four more months, and we've already had to increase our hotel room block. That's what kind of return, what kind of interest we're getting at this event. Annie Pearl Avery, and Mendisa is going to be there as well. Some guy named Seth Andrews is going
to
be there.
I'm working on the speech as we speak. I'm actually starting to put the material together for August, and I'm pretty excited.
Well, it better be good, Seth, because if it ain't good.
No kidding.
If it ain't good, you know, it's just bad.
Well, you know, it's no pressure. You know, you got Cy Babe, you got James Randi, you got all these amazing communicators and presenters and whatnot, but I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be fantastic. And atheist.org/convention2017. Did I get that right?
Yeah, atheists with an S at the end, atheists.org/convention2017. You're going to have a great time. It is a Saturday to Monday convention. It starts Saturday in the middle of the morning, so you can come in Saturday morning, and you don't have to take Friday off from work, but you're going to take Monday off from work because, of course, that's when the total eclipse of the sun is happening at the Atheist Convention for American Atheists. I'm really excited.
The heathen horde gathered, and the day became as black as sackcloth. I can see, you know, it's like the Book of Revelation coming to pass. So
I kind of like that.
All right, David Silver.
That should be the theme of the convention right there.
All right. We'll send everybody your way. I'll see you out there in August. Best wishes on the organization of the entire thing. And thanks for sharing your perspective. I knew you'd have an opinion. We will talk to you real soon, okay?
Thanks for having me on again, Seth. Always a pleasure.
I've got area code 530. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's your name?
Rick.
Do you have any personal experience with religion? Were you ever religious?
Well, now I mean, looking back on it now, no, but I was raised, you know, you can't see me, but I'm doing finger air quotes in the air, Catholic. But it was mostly going to church on the following Sunday after my mom would run into somebody from church at the grocery store. So not really heavily religious, but I was brought up. It was kind of a given that that's how the world worked, but it wasn't so deep that I couldn't get out of it, thankfully.
Hitchens used to talk about how believers think that the universe was designed with them in mind. So while they sort of present this attitude of humility, right? Well, only the atheist is arrogant enough to want to be God. It's actually the religious in that context that's the arrogant one. I mean, it's a tremendous sort of a self-centered approach to the cosmos, you know?
And how could that not poison how they view everything in this world?
Are you an activist in your own right? Do you go out and have these discussions in any way or what?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I run a really great, it's a private Facebook group, but it's called the Atheist Connection, and and I'm involved with the FFRF locally and whenever I can nationally, and I've written quite a bit. So yeah, I do as much as I can. I'm definitely a believer in the. I do most of my work in the separation of church and state area.
Why is the Atheist Connection a closed group? Is it kind of like a safe space for people who might not be out of the closet yet, or what?
Yeah, it wasn't a thing to you know. I didn't make it private as a chicken kind of a move. It was more of, I just felt there were plenty of places for people to air their grievances and bitch and moan about religion. I had a few friends who I thought were kind of on the edge, and they really needed a safe space to ask questions and not feel that their religious relatives were seeing it. And I don't think they would have discussed it in one of the open forums. So I created it that way. You know, people can be invited. There's quite a few pretty well-known people in there. David Fitzgerald, David McAfee. There are quite a few people in the group that are pretty well known in the area. So it is a safe place for people to discuss stuff.
Well, it's nice to see you doing what you can to sort of make a difference. People will often ask, how do I participate? And I'm like, well, find a need and fill it, right? And play to your gifts. Right. And it sounds like you've done that very thing. So kudos to you.
Yeah. Try them.
Any final thoughts on religion, Rick, before we move on?
You know, I'm really glad that you're tackling this topic. And I think it permeates every single part of people's lives. I mean, from government on down. And I think it's really the more we can kind of expose that thought process, it's only going to be a matter of time. And I've always said that at one point there were generational overlaps of people believing in the Greek gods and their kids not. Right. So I think we're in that same kind of a realm, I hope.
Yeah. Hopefully things will become a little easier for the generations to follow. Right. The groundwork that has been laid over the last century will pay some dividends. We certainly hope so.
That's right.
So.
Well, and you're doing your part. I really, really appreciate all that you do.
Thank you so much, Rick. Greatly appreciated.
Great. Thanks, Seth.
Area code 920 on the switchboard. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's your name?
My name's Kevin.
Does religion poison everything, Kevin? What do you think?
Absolutely, Seth. I think it does poison everything, and there's a few specific reasons why. The first being that this thinking in religious terms, this perspective that people have, is completely objective. It's not founded in reason. So therefore, it's subject to change based on the situation.
You say it's objective or subjective?
Subjective. I apologize. Okay. It's subjective based on the circumstance. The refugee crisis that's going on in the world right now is completely erroneous when you look at Christian values and then a very popular right-wing Christian political viewpoint. They're opposites. They believe the same thing religiously, but politically they don't align. So there has to be a justification for it religiously. That being, well, these immigrants, these refugees, these other people that are not me, they believe a different religion. So therefore, they don't qualify to the love and care and unity that Christianity supposedly calls for. That's just one broad example of how this is a poisonous mentality. I'd have to say, when you look at warfare, you look at the conflict in the Middle East that has gone on for so long, it's usually based somewhere in religion. I think that's poisonous.
Is there any instance anywhere where you think it might bring benefits, where it might be necessary?
Sure. I think religion had its place. It's really a testimony to human beings' ability to question their nature. And, you know, 1,000 years ago, we didn't have the technology to view our Earth from a satellite. So people asking, well, where did we come from? What's the purpose of life? The only answer that, you know, our ancestors really could give was one based in religion, a God, a supreme creator. So I think it definitely had its place in the questioning nature of people, but I think it's really stood still in time. I think we now know a lot of the answers to the questions our ancestors had, like, why is there a drought? Why did the volcano erupt? Those types of things. Those questions have really been answered, but that same core belief that there's this outer being in a firmament somewhere hasn't really gone away as our scientific understanding has risen up, especially very recently. So I'm not sure that it really has a place, perhaps maybe in just a meditative, you know, perspective on life, if that's required, but I don't think it's necessary.
Kevin, I appreciate your perspective for the broadcast as we kind of rant and talk a little bit about what religion does and does not. And I'm playing a whole bunch of Hitchens on the show because I'm kind of a Hitchens fan and I'm always looking for an excuse to play the sound bites, you know. But I appreciate your perspective very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
It's an interesting thing to revolve a broadcast around a question. and finish the broadcast without really answering it. I can't speak to whether or not religion poisons everything. I don't know that I know the answer. For my own part, I think I have come to agree with Christopher Hitchens on the question. My perspective is there's really not an instance when we couldn't remove the belief in falsehoods and be better off. I don't think that you have to have religion to have hope. I don't think you have to have religion to have art. I don't think you have to have religion to have tradition or community or family or purpose. Time and time again in my own life, from my own perspective, if I look at a situation and I see someone attaching supernatural belief to it, I think, you know, you could have all of the beauty, all of the amazing stuff. You could even act it out as a work of fiction. You know, if you're like the Satanic Temple or the Church of Satan or those guys, they're theatrical for its own sake. They don't believe in a literal devil, but, you know, they go and create this structure, a religious structure, and it brings benefit and joy to their lives. That's kind of how they want to frame their existence and what they do and how they do it. And they don't have to lie to themselves. There are many secular traditions, secular Jews and so many others, people who they enjoy the tradition, but they've rejected the magical thinking. They've rejected the lies, the debunked information, the bad science, the mystical thinking, the indoctrination. They know the difference between fact and fiction, between truth and myth, and they can enjoy fantasy just like you and I would enjoy, you know, Lord of the Rings or something along those lines without having to cheat ourselves into living a lie. I think I agree with Hitchens. I think in my own life I must take the position that religion poisons everything. I'm going to leave you with a soundbite from Christopher Hitchens. This was from November the 18th, 2010. It was a Hitchens debate against William Dembski, which took place at Prestonwood Baptist Church in Plano, Texas. By the way, next Tuesday, No Illusions of the Scathing Atheist broadcast and of God-awful movies is going to be my special guest on the radio. So I'll see you back here Tuesday for that. And Hitchens will close out the show. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful week.
Why don't you accept this wonderful offer? Why wouldn't you like to meet Shakespeare, for example? I mean, I don't know if you really think that when you die you can be corporeally reassembled and have conversations with authors from previous epochs. It's not necessary that you believe that in Christian theology, and I have to say it sounds like a complete fairy tale to me. The only reason I want to meet Shakespeare, or might even want to, is because I can meet him any time, because he is immortal in the works he's left behind. If you've read those, meeting the author would almost certainly be a disappointment. But when Socrates was sentenced to death for his philosophical investigations and for blasphemy, for challenging the gods of the city, and he accepted his death, he did say, well, if we are lucky, perhaps I'll be able to hold conversation with other great thinkers and philosophers and doubters too. In other words, that the discussion about what is good, what is beautiful, what is noble, what is pure and what is true could always go on. Why is that important? Why would I like to do that? Because that's the only conversation worth having. And whether it goes on or not after I die, I don't know. But I do know that it's the conversation I want to have while I'm still alive. Which means that to me, the offer of certainty, the offer of complete security, the offer of an impermeable faith that can't give way, is an offer of something not worth having. I want to live my life taking the risk all the time that I don't know anything like enough yet, that I haven't understood enough, that I can't know enough, that I'm always hungrily operating on the margins of a potentially great harvest of future knowledge and wisdom. I wouldn't have it any other way. And I'd urge you to look at those of you who tell you, those people who tell you at your age, that you're dead till you believe as they do. What a terrible thing to be telling to children. And that you can only live. And that you can only live by accepting an absolute authority. Don't think of that as a gift. Think of it as a poison chalice. Push it aside, however tempting it is. Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way. Thank you.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.